Well, I mentioned last night about this article, and Neil Hogarth tracked it down. I was referring to in the latest, I believe it's Time magazine, yes, November 16th, one of the more recent Times, might be one or two out since, with its review of Fatal Attraction, which was mentioned on the cover. I want to just read you some of these things because it really does give us a sense of what's coming out of our culture at this time. Talks about these people, and the three, you know, the big triad here is Alex, that's a woman's name in this case, Dan and Beth. Beth is a homemaker. Dan is the unfaithful husband. It all starts, in a sense, with his sin. And three archetypes for him, modern mortality, usually it would be morality play. This is called immortality play on words. Alex Forrest, the career woman whose forcefulness sheathes a precarious ego. Dan Gallagher, a guy who seems to have embraced the personal and career contradictions in a big, easy bear hug. Beth Gallagher, comfortable in her roles as wife, mother, and natural stunner. But what if Alex is a creature of insatiable lust and leeching possessiveness, and if Dan's amiability has made him too soft to resist Alex's attentions or later to protect his family from her vengeance? So from the beginning, you know, the male hero is flawed. He's too soft to get the job done as far as protecting his family. And that's how they introduce you to the plot, and it continues. Later, he's afraid to deal with the situation and tell his wife what's happened, that he's gotten this woman pregnant after their one time, or whatever it was, affair. To tell Beth about Alex would be to deface the greeting card. That is the pretty picture they have of their lives. He must deal like a man with the crisis he has helped to create, but Dan is not a man, at least not the John Wayne movie man. He's a soft guy in a tough spot. Even after Alex boils Ellen's pet rabbit on the country cottage stove, Dan cannot inform Beth that he and Alex were lovers. And I'll read this just as it's written without comment. Beth has to elicit that fact by asking him directly. The women have the cojones in this picture. I will not translate. It is Beth who will earn the movie's first cheer when she tells Alex, if you ever come near my family again, I'll kill you. You understand? And Alex, who will take Beth up on her dare, swiping Ellen, the daughter, from school for an almost innocuous afternoon kidnapping. The outraged husband tries taking matters into his own hands by strangling Alex back in her kitchen. Be a movie man, Dan, but he can't finish the job. This demon will have to be destroyed by the only pure spirit left, and of course that's Beth. Later here, when she's in the house, Alex, that is, trying to kill Beth, who is this presumptuous intruder in Alex's dream cottage? Someone who doesn't deserve to play happy family. Someone who deserves to die. Their struggle for the knife finally alerts Dan, who rushes upstairs, overpowers Alex, and forces her into the tub. She struggles, then ceases, blood rising from her mouth. Love the picture, you love it. But you can't keep a bad woman down. Alex screams. And Alex springs, screaming from the tub, and slashes at Dan, as Beth appears brandishing a handgun, and kills Alex with a bullet through the chest. So she finally gets the job done. That's the plot. Later the analysis goes along these lines. Indeed, this story, stripped to its essentials, is the stuff of many an old movie weepy. Boy meets girl for a brief encounter. Boy gets girl pregnant, then disappears. Girl falls in love with boy, tries to get him back. In those films, though, the lovesick female was the heroine, and a rogue male was the villain. Fatal Attraction switches genders. The usual formula for our time. Role reversal, gender reversal. And presto becomes a homily or sermon for our time. For our time, the 80s, the role reverse era. In traditional melodrama, the ostensibly weak must triumph over the seemingly invincible. And that usually means a clash between a good woman and an evil man. But this time, Dan is the vulnerable one. He is the feminized male, partly because of his position as head of the family. And his adversary is scarily strong, a masculinized female, even in name, Alex. And it's curious that she is played by a woman with a masculine name, Glenn. G-L-E-N-N, close, who is the leading lady in this film, leading something in this film. Anyway, she is this Alex character, the stalker, the demon, the sexual adventurer. In other words, the one who takes the active lead in everything. And later on in the final column, in this movie, women have the power, positively and negatively. When Alex hears Dan threaten her, she doesn't take it seriously. But when Beth tells Alex she is going to kill her, Alex trembles. So, it's just a review of the film, briefly, and then it does review Glenn Close afterwards. The reaction to the film indicates that the whole male-female thing, this is a quote in this country, is very volatile right now. I think many women are feeling used by men. That's true. That's wrong. That's part of the problem, of course, and needs to be addressed. They invest a lot in a relationship, in nurturing a man emotionally and in his career, and then they have their own careers and emotions, but they have their own careers and emotions, and they don't get that nurturing in return. That can be very true, and that is a great evil. And they can also be, their husbands can also be found unfaithful, which is the double standard that prevailed for a long time in most cultures, including ours, prior to this time. Now it's no longer the double standard. Everybody does it, and that's seen as the fair solution, right? You're going to screw around, I'm going to screw around, we might as well all do it. You know, I'm not going to have double standard here. That's not the solution. Nobody should do so. And then you wouldn't have the problem, but our culture has solved it a different way. Final paragraph, for all her humor, beauty, and success, quote says she has found it, her personal comment here is, difficult to balance love and career. Her first marriage at 21 to rock guitarist Cabot Wade lasted 3 years, as did her second to James Marlis, the Manhattan venture capitalist. The man in her life now is producer John Stark, 37, who worked with her on GARP and is her partner in developing film projects. The two are expecting their first child in April and May. Unlike Alex, but rather like her favorite heroine, Jenny Fields, the defiantly unwed mother of Garth, Close has no plans to marry. Bottom line.
Well, I mean, this is straight out of our times. Have kids, don't marry, pursue your career, don't let any marriages drag you down.
It is, as they say here, the perfect commentary or homily on our times. So you have to understand, and that's the point I was making last time, the kinds of cultural input, cues, directions you get slammed at you continuously. And this isn't new. You can go back into the films of the late 70s. An Unmarried Woman, Bill Claiborne. I don't know if you were seeing that film in 79. That goes back a ways. But this glamorization of divorce at that time that was coming out in the film. Kramer and Kramer and other flicks that were having a romanticized view of divorce and the liberated female. Final scene in Unmarried Woman finds her after her divorce walking down the street in New York carrying her giant painting off to some art show is kind of the idea. And she's past now needing a man and she's launching her artsy career, you know, on her own, and you're supposed to cheer the heroine. Isn't that neat? You know, and film after film has come out that way, or films you've seen it, where the woman in the final scene or some scene turns her heel on the man, walks away. Very unsatisfying emotionally if you like romantic films, but again, part of our time is the woman is in power. She says, I don't want or need you. Buzz off, Harry Legs. Boom! You know, and everybody's supposed to cheer. Woo, isn't that neat? She doesn't need it. Wow, it's great, you know. And this is the scripting and the programming that lots of folks, yourselves included, have had. I mean, since you began being aware of media, you know, these themes have been present. This isn't the time of, you know, Gone with the Wind and My Fair Lady and Julie Andrews, you know, what's her film, you know, Sound of Music, you know, long gone, that stuff. These aren't, you know, the classic comedy musicals of the 50s and 60s, folks. These are the films of the 70s and 80s that shape people's thinking far more than anything else. Satan uses the media, I think, more than anything to shape people's thinking. Advertising follows right along with that. So, I just thought maybe a brief review of that would be in order. And do read, you know, things like this. I mean, I read things like this so that I don't go to some film, pay $5 a shot, you know, and then find out what a crummy movie it is. I'd just as soon have Time Magazine tell me and save me $10 and take my wife usually, you know, go out and do something better with the money and get ripped off in that kind of film and come away feeling yuck. Or walk out right in the middle of it feeling yuck. Okay, back to 1 Peter. And I will open it up to questions when I get there. But I do just want to comment on verse 4 and verse 7. This whole thing starts off how? With him, Dan, committing adultery with this gal. So sin begins to be the opening line. And so he's going to mess up his marriage, and his wife, therefore, feels obliged to step in and protect her home, her daughter, her marriage. Okay, humanly, that's understandable. That's the rationale that is understandable. What he isn't doing is what this verse says here. 3, verse 7. Likewise, you husbands are told, dwell with them with understanding. Of course, I mean, adultery is the classic lack of understanding. You don't go smashing your relationships in marriage with infidelity. God's law gives us that understanding, but the world doesn't have it. To him, the way the film depicts it, it's just a casual affair, no big deal. You know, this poor crazy lady's starting to slash her wrists right after, you know, the first date when he's walking out after using her and trying to get his attention by doing that. Later, she finds she's pregnant.
Of course she's desperate. You know, she's pregnant as a result of this affair. She loves him. It just starts off with sin and its morbid, sick consequences. Do those things happen? Hey, I understand People magazine. Somebody was telling me they've got about 5 different versions of this that have happened in real life. In one case, somebody was telling me about last night, the wife chopped up right here in Dallas. You know, not the man, but the woman, what we call her, you know, the villain in the plot here. The other woman with an axe, you know, or a hatchet, goes at it. People do these things. Proverbs are full of warnings against jealous lovers. It says, don't do that. People will accuse a thief who steals because he's hungry. But you're going to have a hard time talking to a jealous lover with a handgun, you know. He's not going to listen to what you have to say if he proceeds to put holes in your body, you know. That's a rough paraphrase. But it's a modern interpretation and a practical one. So you dwell with them with understanding. If men had done this, if there'd been less adultery, fornication, and other kinds of unfaithfulness, women wouldn't be in the position they are. And I understand the motivation for the thing of careers. How many women have grown up looking at their own moms, whom their fathers and their mom's husbands dumped in midlife and walked away, leaving mom to sort it out after 20 years of faithful marriage as a homemaker? He splits, leaves her to raise the kids, live on welfare. Daughters, you know, take their cues from this and say, no way. Mothers, meanwhile, are saying, daughter, if you've got a brain in your head, don't ever get yourself in this position. You know, she feels ripped off. She scripts her daughter to believe that she should never, what, marry? I don't know if that's it, but be independent. So if he walks out and bails out, you are free and you don't have to depend on him. So it's the men's craziness and violation of God's law that often forces women to have to be asking questions like, what's going to happen when this whole thing falls in? Now, 30, 50 years ago, you didn't worry about that too much. Men weren't walking out on their wives, and women didn't have to worry about that nearly as much as in today's world, where we know roughly half the marriages end in divorce, which of course make this kind of response by women. I understand what the historic circumstances. But what if husbands dwelt with them with understanding and faithfulness and patience and kindness and love, and as it says, gave honor to the wife, as to what the Bible calls, and is appropriate, the weaker vessel, and that's true in many respects, as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. Then it wouldn't be that same kind of situation. Now let me just comment further on what I was saying last time, even at the risk of not getting into 1 Peter 5, and if we don't, that will leave a beautiful stretch of scripture for somebody else, probably Dr. Ward, who will love going through it, I'm sure. Because it's about elders and two elders, and it's a fun passage, but let me indicate that it's not wrong, because when women will ask this question, look, I have no guarantee I'm going to get married during college. I could come right through this experience and be single after, just like a bunch of those ladies are every year, and I got to be prepared to support myself. Right. And I'm not suggesting you shouldn't do so. And it's not wrong to have an education or to have good job potential. But the things that I was saying last time, let me clarify. I would say, one, watch for the attitude of independence, which finds you saying in so many words, consciously or unconsciously, I want to be in the position where I don't need a man. And why did I tell you that? You know, I repeat, because when you get yourself in the position where you are consciously or unconsciously telegraphing that message to all the potential men in your life, they'll get it figured out and they won't need you either. You know? Is it okay to say that a man needs to be needed? Yes, it is. Is it okay to say that a woman needs to be needed? Yes, it is. You are to be in complementary and mutually dependent needs. It's okay to need each other. Despite Kenny Rogers' tune to the contrary a few years ago, you know, where he blasts out there for all the world because of Satan's scripting with his country western tune, we don't need each other, baby, you know. God, again, tune right out of the 80s. Or do we, he asked rhetorically in the end. You know, that's the best you can get out of me. It's kind of reevaluating the question after singing the line for 16 times through the tune. He comes back thinking, well, on the other hand, do we? We don't need each other, but we sure want it. That's true. You know, we want each other's bodies, but we don't really need each other. Oh, yuck. What a lovely age, you know. This world does not have superior information or wisdom about how to run relationships. It's running them Satan's way, and they get all bashed up in the end, and everybody loses. Crazy. So watch that attitude of independence. Yes, you have to support yourself if you're not married after college, but I'd say if you don't watch your attitude, you almost guarantee you won't be. And I've seen women do this. And in their third and fourth years, it's like, you know, the old Aesop's fable about the tortoise and the hare, or who was it? No, it was the fox, you know, who didn't need the grapes either. You know, don't want any of those dumb grapes. They're probably sour. You know, sour grapes attitude toward marriage, toward men. Men are all turkeys anyway. They're all weak. They're all feminine. They're all wimps. Nobody loves me. Nobody cares. Nobody ever will. I don't need them either. You know, you get into that attitude. I've seen people do it. Therefore, I will be strong. I will be brave. I will have my job. And yes, you can do all those things. Just as well in today's world as men, maybe easier and better, as I already explained and conceded. I'll show them I don't need them. I'll make more money, have a bigger car, a nicer apartment. I don't need you. Okay, you know, that's what turns you on or off. You know, do it. But I don't think it's going to bring you great happiness on a Saturday night, you know, as you sit there watching a rerun on TV or something, you know. Okay, two, I would say, in preparing for careers, many women invest so much in their career, they want to be in business, and so they get an MBA from Harvard or something, you know. If you do that, it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. As I said before, you sock 6 or 8 years of your life, or 4 to 6 or whatever, in some profession, and you're going to want to go do that profession. All your scripting for years is going to be business manager in the corporate world. A lot of women think that's the greatest thing in the world. They want to be a CEO at 27. Show those men, you know. Okay, but this will be to the neglect, in virtually every case, of preparation for the profession of wife and mother. How about preparing professionally with the same kind of attention to detail, same concern for the highest profession a woman can have? How about professionally addressing the issue of things like diet and nutrition, homemaking, interior decorating, childbirth, child rearing, you know, garment construction? Of course, that's out. That's domestic. You don't want to be a domestic, do you, dearie? What's wrong with you? You know, I've had, you know, Simone's been told things like this, not of course the women in the church, but it's kind of cute, like, how domestic. Isn't that cute? She's taking what? Home economics. Isn't that silly? She wants to sew. Aww. Isn't that sweet, old-fashioned girl? You know, heavy cynicism throughout. You know, you turkey, you know, you dummy, you don't know nothing. You're going to do what? Cook and sew. Aw, ain't that cute? You know, that's about the best you can expect from Satan's world for wanting to prepare for the highest profession God gives women. It's a sneer, you know. But don't expect to get your stroke from Satan's world on this issue. Say to yourself, you're the one that doesn't know the score, honey. You know, you don't know where it's at. When I go to bed every night, you know, I'm going to sleep with that man right next to me. And that's more than you're going to do when you go to bed with your legal briefs or whatever you're preparing for tomorrow morning, you know. And they do, you know. They do sleep with their jobs. I mean, my daughter, Jenny, worked with a gal like that in an insurance company. She was down there till 9 or 10 o'clock on many a night, smoking cigarettes and knocking down Diet Coke and coffee to try to stay awake to get her work done so she'd be ready the next day. I'm not convinced, I'll tell you, you can call this sexism if you want, that women are capable of competing on an equal basis with men in the marketplace, based on the observation that my daughters have brought home to me. Some few? Yes. Usually at the cost of all their femininity. They're crisp, efficient, graceless, hard-mouthed, hard-eyed, stiff-bodied, and totally unlovely. In virtually every case I know. You know, they sell their femininity down the drain. But lots of the rest, frankly, you all need to know, struggle. They are not as well equipped in a lot of ways, including emotionally. And where, in Jenny's observation, I argue with her, not me if you want to, but she worked out there for a couple of years. When the guys are going home at 5 or 6 o'clock and chucking it all in and saying they're going to go down to the bar and have a beer, go play racquetball or whatever, lots of the ladies were still there, you know, including her boss, trying to sort it all out and be ready the next day. Now, maybe it was just her boss, and maybe her boss wasn't as well equipped as some of the ladies. I don't know. But that was her consistent impression that the men were just on top of it more. I feel that God has equipped men to handle those kinds of pressures better. The flip side of the coin is, God has equipped women to handle the whole task of running a home infinitely better. I'm not talking one better than the other. I'm talking about God preparing them for their individual roles. Man, the way I live when I am alone, the way I take care of a house, the way I feed myself, is horrible. I would start breaking down, dying, you know, today. I did it. I know, for a long time, after I was divorced, prior to my remarriage, I have batched. I know what it's like. Do I make a lovely, beautiful environment for myself? You know?
No.
Does it, you know, is it nutritionally sound? No. Can you live that way very long? Probably not, you know. So I declare my inferiority in a lot of these areas. And I declare the women's superiority. This isn't us versus them. Don't hear it that way. It's just what God has created to work right. Okay. So, again, what about preparing professionally and having that same kind of attention detail for the role? Then what? Well, let me just ask this. Which will God bless more in terms of your happiness, your marriage? Which is God going to bless? When it comes time to, you know, giving you a husband, I would say that he's going to bless your preparation if that's what you've been preparing for. Now, if you're prepared to become a business manager in the corporate world, then that's probably what you're going to become. It becomes, as I say, a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then they'll ask, if you, what if your husband dies? That's funny. That's where the whole argument begins for so many. What if your husband dies? You never know when he's going to die. Okay, number one, how often does it happen? What's the odds? Do most husbands just drop over 35, 40? Well, dead, you know. I mean, maybe, what, 1 out of 100? I don't think it's that many. The people we know in God's church just die in the middle of life. Boom, they're dead.
Now, some do, I grant you.
Very, very few. I suppose just as many wives died among the ranks of the ministry. I suppose the husbands ought to be asking the question, what if my wife died? Therefore, I'd always go do what? Take cooking classes? Is that it? Heard a lot more about that than we have the other. But anyway, it isn't going to happen in most cases. What if he walks out on me? Same comment. How about a little faith? You know, probably, let's say that's the 1%. Are you going to build your life around the 1% possibility? I don't think that makes good sense. But furthermore, okay, let's face it. So he dies. Okay? It doesn't happen, but if it happens, then what? You automatically just have to snap into, boom, corporate world, you know, with an executive job to solve the problem? Is there the possibility that if you were known as a fantastic mother, homemaker, wife, and all the other good things that Lady Beth in this film is supposed to depict so well? Let's read it again. Gee, he looks like what? Beautiful. Here it is. Wife, gorgeous homemaker, spirited, nurturing, and vision of chic domesticity. All right. If you're all these things, you know, incidentally, Beth means what in Hebrew? After home. You know, beautiful name. Choice. Anyway, any chance you might maybe remarry? Has it ever crossed your mind that other people might have seen this over the years and say, hey, click, you know, it happens. You know, it just may be possible that if you were that good, somebody would say, I would like to marry you, and you wouldn't even be available too long. Allow for that, okay? There are other solutions than snapping back into the corporate world at the executive level, you know? And there's faith that has to figure in all of this, that God would help you through those times of crisis and trial, and you wouldn't necessarily just be dumped on your head and left on welfare, you know? I think there are other kinds of solutions that God would help you with. Okay, now we shouldn't take forever. We've already taken 25 minutes with it, but I did promise I would open it up to questions, and so we'll take a few, even though it guarantees we'll never see 1 Peter 5. Any further questions or comments? I've seen women face that issue very successfully. It happens. I mean, but you build your whole life around that unlikely possibility. To me, that's like, this doesn't make any sense in terms of the odds. You're building your life around the 1 in 100 possibility, ignoring the 99. What do you do about it?
Wrong. Dr. Mance would not agree with that.
What do you do about it? I don't know. You're not responsible for fixing everybody's everything, you know. You don't have any great responsibility to go and sort these all out for somebody else. Sort it out for yourself and hope they're doing the same. And among your closest personal friends, you know, iron sharpens iron. If you've got friends, be it male or female, with whom you can discuss these things, and you have enough of a relationship that you can do that, fine. But to walk up to some guy you heard about, you know, in the freshman class and say, you don't know anything to so, I'm going to tell you about that because I'm a sophomore here. You know? I don't think it would work real well. Let some visitor from Pasadena who's going to leave on the weekend come down and sort it out. You go away free, you know. Why should you get messed up in a bloody argument, right?
What should we do about it? Solve it for yourself and let everybody do the same, I would say. Probably the best advice on an individual basis. What else?
Yes.
I recognize you. You were here the other day, weren't you?
He was learning at the feet of his instructor. I love his great response. Wow, hey, here I am learning at the feet of my instructor. That's a quick recovery. Very good. We'll give you high marks for that. Okay. I know. That'll happen. Anybody else, you'll get it. No.
Yeah. Go ahead. Okay, that reminds me of a comment I want to make immediately in that connection. Thank you. What about looking at what I would call sexually appropriate professions or jobs, vocations, which I think teaching is wonderful. I mean, everything you've learned about teaching could apply to your own kids, right? So beautiful. I had a friend whose wife loved trucks, Peterbilt, Mack, whatever. She wanted to be a truck driver. She wasn't in the church. Okay, somebody I met in graduate school. I don't call that a sexually appropriate profession, you know. Female truck driver. You see them occasionally out there on the highway, right? Now, there's a lot of bus drivers. Big gals.
Oh, driving those buses.
You don't mess with those ladies. They run you right down. What was that? A pedestrian. Oh, never mind. There's lots more out here, you know. Look out, Turk. I need this lane. I know some professions just don't strike me as the perfect expression of femininity, you know. But there are some. Great. What about getting big into interior design, artsy stuff, you know? Be able to decorate the whole thing, you know, a house. What about the arts? What about other things that would have direct expression in a home when and if God gave you one? That seems beautiful to me. And a lot nicer environment in which to work. The corporate environment out there is not lovely. The business environment is abrasive. It runs by the get principle. And people out there colliding and bruising each other on a daily basis. Let the men go have their ulcers and migraines, you know, and drug problems, you know. Stay home or go somewhere where it's soft and nice and beautiful. Run an art store, you know. Sell diamonds and pearls and rings and, you know, do other kinds of things that are gentler on the spirit. You'll live longer. And let them beat themselves up out of it. Be smart, you know. Be charming. In the family setting? Mm-hmm. That's a sensitive issue. Paul addresses it to 1 Peter. I mean, in, no, he doesn't. In 1 Timothy. I know the answer to that is false. I don't think it's impossible for a woman to discipline her children. I do agree that her emotions are going to tend to be more in it, and it's a little hard for a woman to remain dispassionate and on top of things. I wanted to mention this last time. Verse 11, let a woman learn in silence with all submission. Very similar to 1 Corinthians 14. Where it says that the women are to learn in silence and ask their questions at home of their husbands. Amazing. We could turn there and refer to that. But anyway, 1 Timothy 2:11, let a woman learn in silence with all submission, showing that she's very submissive even during the learning process. You ever see a noisy woman at church? I think it's a very distasteful thing when a woman charged up the minister, especially in the presence of her husband, has all these Bible questions, you know, takes an active lead in all matters of the church. You see this, the upside-down church family, where the woman's the voluble, noisy spokesperson, talking about all these spiritual issues with the minister and showing her Bible knowledge. It's just uncomely. Why don't you ask your husband at home, the way Paul said? Why don't you go through your head, and if he has a question, let him ask the minister. And not you demonstrate for all the world to hear how much you know about the Bible. It's crazy, but you see that sometimes. I do not permit, Paul says, a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. That kind of situation is common in the world where you have women over men. And it seems to be a clear violation of this Bible principle. I don't think God intended that women be bossing around men. I think it's hard on everybody. And that's a kind of situation I think should be studiously avoided by a woman. But that's the management leadership role that women are charging into with their little briefcases and three-piece suits all the time. I even saw a gal carry that out to its logical extreme. I suppose in Oregon one time in Eugene, she had the whole outfit and a pipe. That kind of completes the image, doesn't it? You know, blows pipe smoke in somebody else's face. You're totally liberated, baby. I'm a long way. Past cigarettes now. Pipe. Okay. So, yes, I think exercising authority is more difficult for a woman emotionally, and God hasn't given her the physical size or strength or even voice. You know, for a woman to raise her voice and scream at kids doesn't carry the same weight. I mean, women will often be the first to tell you.
Dad says the kid does it when he stands in screens all day. Never happens, you know.
I don't think the woman has to be ineffective in exercising authority over children. She can be quite effective, and a lot of women are, but it is a little more difficult. God hasn't equipped them with the same things that it takes to exercise authority, and least of all, Paul is saying, in the area of public speaking, where it is simply not allowed in the church for women to be a vocal leader. Not opening prayers, sermonettes, announcements, sermons, closing prayers, or even church choirs. You know, we don't put women in those positions. Over a kiddie choir, I guess in a few cases we've done that. But we solve that problem in the church that way. Well, correct. Ken, that's tricky. I mean, you're talking about right here in the campus situation. How could you bring to somebody else's attention a matter that was corrective? I think in the spirit of Matthew 18 and going to your brother, there's a time and a place. I think husbands and wives need to be able to take things off of each other, and the scripture suggests the same in Ephesians 5 when it says, submit yourselves one to another. There is a time when the husband should hear the counsel of his wife, and if she goes at it in the attitude that's described here in 1 Peter, all the while with her attitude calling him Lord. In other words, with deep respect for his office and his position, you aren't being overbearing, but you are expressing concern. Again, if there's a strong relationship, I think some of you men could take that off of a female friend on campus if she went at it with the right attitude, no big problem. If she got real uppity and high-minded and proud and, you know, oppressive about it, it'd be a problem. But then that'd just be true for you if you came on that one. If you came on in a high-handed, arbitrary manner, that'd make it very difficult for anybody. So attitude, I think, is the key. I don't want to rule out the possibility that sometimes a woman has to correct a man or at least call something to his attention. My wife does that for me, and it's good, you know, that your chief counsel can do that in the family. And I'd be a fool to dismiss her counsel. So there's a kind of place to submit to one another. It isn't a one-way street. But I think the attitude is a key factor. The tough ones, you know, when the kid's been smarting off all day long, mom ought to say, when your dad gets home, I'm going to deal with this. He's going to deal with this. And then he should, you know. He should handle the tough situations and the repeated situations and back her and teach those kids, you are never going to get by with that. That woman is my wife and your mother. And you living off to her is just about the worst mistake you'll ever make, you know. And you prove it, you know. And boy, do they start cooperating with mom, you know. And that's the only way to go. You always back each other. You always back your wife. The wife always backs her husband, and the kid learned they're never going to win. Never going to beat those two. They always stand together. Every time I try to split them, they just draw closer, and I lose, you know. If that's their consistent learning experience, pretty soon they just give it up and say, Dad says it or Mom says it, it doesn't make any difference because that's what we got to do. Boom. Solves the problem. It's only when they can win by pitting one against the other that they keep up that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm Dad. That can be done to an extreme, I'll grant you. If it's always a threat, and it makes Dad look like the bad guy, and you're always either the weak, ineffectual one, or the good guy, I grant, there can be an imbalance. But still in all, I think those, you know, cases of, well, heavy hand is needed, and the kid is not getting it to the best of mom's efforts, indeed, wait till Dad gets home. He better be a little. No matter how he handles it, I guess. I grant, the Dad should not come off always as the heavy. Hey, family relations are tricky. You know, Paul says in the same chapter, Ephesians 5, this is a mystery. You got it. You know, family relations are profound. They aren't the first thing that occurs to your natural mind. To get all this sorted out, and especially the authority factor, is the hardest thing for the carnal mind to get figured out. But we have this inbred, built-in resistance to authority. You know, we fight with it. Kids fight with their parents' authority, wives fight with their husband's authority, men fight with the church's authority. Fortunately, Christ doesn't fight with the Father's authority. He's got that straight, and he's teaching us to get it straight, and we will, and we are. But we all have a lot to learn. It's one of the biggest, most central issues in life. The centurion in Matthew 8 had it all figured out. Matthew 8 and verse 9, I believe it is, I am a man under authority. Men didn't say that. I am a man under authority. And women need to say that. I am a woman under authority. A kid better be taught that attitude. I am a child under authority. Wouldn't be bad to teach him to say that. We're all under authority, except God the Father. And when we understand that, we learn how our roles function, and we get on with the program. Okay, let us at 9:15 close down that discussion. I do want to point out one thing. In Proverbs 31, speaking of dwelling with your wife according to understanding, it does say, you recall, the one thing it quotes the husband is saying is, he praises her, saying, many women or daughters have done well, but you excel them all. You are, in other words, the best. And it's a beautiful thing to note the power of praise and encouragement. The man who is dwelling with his wife according to knowledge will be doing that. You track it down. It's there right above the chapter. I'm sure you're going. How the chapter ends, quoting him as saying, you are the best. He praises her, and the children rise up and call her blessed. In other words, she gets a lot of strokes, a lot of payoff for being this kind of woman. It's rewarding. Now, if the husband doesn't reward that because he is, as Colossians warns against, harsh, Colossians 3, if he's hard on her, if he's insensitive, if he grinds on her with his bitter, hardened attitude and beats down her emotions, he's going to turn her off. And many men have turned off the love and affection and warmth of a good woman by his stupidity, by not dwelling with her according to knowledge and giving honor to her. In simple things, even. I mean, just get in the habit of opening the door for your date or your wife and just showing her respect, lifting the heavy objects for her, stepping in there, being there, and taking the lead in being a protector and provider for your spouse. And give her that honor so that her role is rewarding. There's a lot of hard work in a wife's role. And it is tough. You know, fixing meals 3 times a day and doing the dishes, and when you get into the whole diaper routine, that isn't the funnest thing in the world to start your morning with dirty diapers and changing some kid's pants. You know, yeah. First thing you see in the morning. I mean, you don't need to start your day that way. Yeah, but you do. If it's your child, you do. So make that rewarding and pay off. Lots. Bring her flowers. Take her out to dinner. If it doesn't pay off, and some of my basic thoughts about marriage is it has to seem fair. And the day it doesn't seem fair, that you're putting out a whole lot more than you're getting back, it's going to be hard. You might do it, but it isn't going to be great fun. So you make it your business, both of you, to put out a lot so that it seems wonderful and reinforcing and beautiful. You've got to have the smarts to do that. Some people don't. Expect people to go on putting out a long time with very little by way of dividend or reward. You are heirs together the grace of life, and the warning here, particularly to the husband, is if you don't have smarts about how you do your role, your prayers are going to be hindered. And if that wife is grieving and hurting and beat down and oppressed because you're some kind of a family tyrant with a loud voice and nutty notions about things that are beating everybody into submission, and I'm not advocating that by any means, then God isn't going to be pleased to answer your prayers. And you aren't going to be a spiritual leader if you're a tyrant and oppressor. Mr. DeCosta has warned against that type of thing in the pages of Worldwide News. He doesn't want people who come off looking wonderful in the church situation for the neglect of the entire family. He has addressed that as much as anything else, including in his feast sermon, right? That was one of his big points that I recall from the feast. He wants us to get these things resolved beautifully and then move out into the church. Okay, I don't have a lot of comments on the verses that follow. Up to about verse 15, I'm going to have to make some time here. I'm going to do it by skipping right over some things that seem pretty much self-explanatory. The Bible does say in verse 15 to be ready to give an answer, or a defense, as it says here, to everyone who asks you. I don't have a lot of comment on that, other than to say that's something you learn to do in a bachelor's college, is have lots of answers. I will say you can take it almost to the opposite extreme. You get so full of answers that you're almost waiting for people to ask questions, you know. Boy, ask me. Boy, do I have the answers. I came out of AC that way. All these elaborate, you know, answers in the margins of my Bible and the cross-references from Genesis to Revelation, 10 different ways you can prove this and 16 ways you can prove that. And you go out there thinking, boy, who's going to ask me now? You know what? Hardly anybody. What I found is they do have questions, but you get about one sentence into the answer. You say, what does the church teach about this or that? You shouldn't do it. And let me show you, what does the church teach about this or that? You know, all they want is the answer. They didn't want 10 pages of truth in most cases. Such a disappointment. I had it all ready to go. And if you say, well, Mr. Armstrong always said that was wrong, that's enough. Boom. Now, you do have some that want the full version, but it's like 1 time out of 1,000. A little discouraging. what can I say? You can sometimes have almost more answers than people have questions.
But it is good to know the answers and be prepared to defend them in balance. You have to tailor your answers to how much people are willing to listen to. And if they got 10 questions and you only have 15 minutes, you probably ought to get through it pretty quick. It could take 45 minutes with each one, it wouldn't work. So balance that out a little bit. I think most of us do get pretty good answers. At least you're prepared to, by virtue of going to AC. Do you need to comment on the verses 18, 19, 20, 21? Christ suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, be put to death in the flesh, be made alive by the Spirit, by which, verse 19, or by whom it says, should be which. Also he went and preached to the spirits in prison. Christ, by means of the Spirit, preached to imprisoned spirits. And a lot of churches, including the Lutheran church that I grew up in, try to say that this was during his 3 days and three nights in the grave, that he wasn't really dead in a tomb. He took that opportunity to go down and preach to the demons. It doesn't say that, but that's the usual Protestant misunderstanding of this verse. It says the when factor is they were formerly disobedient, of course, a long time before this, and it seems that he did this preaching. It isn't just that they were disobedient in the days of Noah. They were disobedient far before that, but he preached when, the when factor is answered in the verse, once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah. So evidently, in that 120-year period or whatever, during the time up to and maybe even during the flood, God took the opportunity, for reasons of his own, to talk to the demons. And the usual explanation that is assigned this as to why seize on that opportunity to preach to demons is that it would seem that God was going to witness to them. That, look, all you have done in this pre-flood world and all the craziness and all the things that have gone on here is going to come to an end. Don't ask me why God witnesses to and preaches to demons. I don't know what kind of relationship God has with angels or demons. That's a whole different realm of experience about which we can only guess and speculate. It's fascinating, and sometime we'll know why witness to beings that seem doomed or lost. I don't know. But there is some kind of ongoing relationship that God has, even right down to the time he's going to cast Satan out of heaven for the final time, and the days still ahead, and then deal with it. So he's got ongoing demons with even the fallen angels, and he was preaching to them then in the days of Noah, while the ark was preparing, being prepared, and eight souls were saved through water at the time of the flood. So that's just one thing to point out as to the timing of that preaching that Christ did by the Spirit to the demons. And you can contrast that. As far as demons in prison, chapter 2, 2 Peter 2 and verse 4 also speaks of them in chains and imprisoned. And I think I know at least one Greek word here that I will hit you with. And that's Tartaru, because it's given in the margin. Verse 4, 2 Peter 2, 4. If God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell, the word is Tartaru, or Tartarus, and it means evidently something like jail or place of restraint, and delivered them into chains of darkness, it's a curious phrase. They are imprisoned, they are restrained, Satan still appears as an angel of light, but I think even their brilliance and their glory has seemingly been reduced, and they are somehow restrained, and will be further restrained during the millennium, and that isn't even the end of the day. They'll be put into an abyss, and then ultimately sent and thrown out into outer darkness. So all this is very strange and outside of our experience, and you can hardly comment on it. That's something for God to work out according to what he thinks is fair and just, and we'll just see it happen, and I don't know, maybe even have something to do with it at some point in time. Paul says, because you know that we will judge angels, 1 Corinthians 6. But at this point in time, we're not qualified to do that. Maybe after being in God's kingdom for 1,000 years of spirit beings and having the mind of God fully, we would have some input. I think angels will be rewarded for good works, just as fallen angels will be, you know, punished for their bad ones. And maybe the degree of the reward and punishment will vary. I don't know. Otherwise, why have a judgment? If it's all the same, just say it's all the same. You get this and you get that. But will there be varying degrees? Time will tell. Okay, now there's a type. It says in verse 21, this is also an antitype, namely the ark, which saves us, or there is an antitype to the ark, and that's baptism. Throughout the scripture, there are various things where people were saved going through water. The flood was such a thing, going through the Red Sea when Israel came out of Egypt, later crossing the Jordan River, where God seems to walk people through water as types of baptism later on. And they were saved
through the experience of coming through the water. And that's what Peter is saying here about the ark. We too come through the water and are saved in baptism. And the comment is made, it's a good one. That doesn't take care of the filth of the body, Peter says, but it is. Baptism is the answer of a good conscience toward God. Simple way of looking at when a person is ready for baptism, after repenting, and this is part of the process, he comes clean in his conscience. He has a good conscience. He acknowledges his sin. He takes responsibility for it. He quits doing the things that were wrong according to God's law. He is acting in good faith with a clean conscience toward God. That kind of person is certainly approaching readiness for baptism. There may be a few things to fine-tune, some details, but that kind of full-hearted, decent, clean response to God is what he's looking for. That kind of person should be baptized soon after he reaches that state of mind. As long as his conscience is being defiled by wrong deeds and has given up certain things and dealt with them appropriately, then he's not ready. Okay. Now, I think most of that is self-explanatory. I don't mean to diminish the importance of these things, but there isn't really time to comment on all of this. Certainly ought to at least get chapter 4 done. How late can we go? 10. Okay. Chapter 4 and verse 1 is interesting. Therefore, since Christ suffered, and one of the key words in this book is suffering, Peter knew a lot about it. Had suffered, did many things for God, and he would suffer additional things before it was all over. That's, I don't know, is that just partly the way Peter had needed it? I don't know. Some people, it seems, do learn more that way than others. And perhaps strong people like Peter, you know, who are outspoken and dynamic, maybe that's just part of their learning experience. You know, we say about some people take 2x4 to get their attention. I'm not sure that was Peter's problem, but there are people who just kind of marvel at in life. They just seem to learn everything the hard way. I can't be sure that's Peter, but he sure did learn a lot about suffering and through suffering and talks a lot about it. And others seem to not have that experience and maybe don't need it as much. Learn things easier, better, hard to say. But what he says is certainly true. Since Christ has suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind, for or because, he says, he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. Now that can't mean Christ, because Christ didn't sin. Consequently, it's appropriately rendered here in the New King James Version with a small h, he, little h, us, in other words, me. It sometimes takes suffering in the flesh to cease from sin. And I think sometimes this is easier to see in other people's lives than our own. But we know from our dealings with some people, we say, you know, you just can't tell him or her anything. You know, they are not going to take it off of me. And I have tried to tell them, but they don't listen. And I suspect they're just going to have to learn this the hard way. I've had to say that about my kids on various occasions. And it's not fun to say that about your kids, but you just know it. Did your parents say similar things about you? Probably so, you know. You get to the point where you don't want to hear it off them anymore. You want to do your own thing. And they kind of stand back and say, well, okay, you know, I'll help sort it out, maybe, if you want my help. But it is true. Once you have suffered in the flesh, you know, AIDS victims, to make a really dramatic point, probably don't have the same enthusiasm for their sexual liaisons that they had before AIDS. Would you believe that's true? You know, that's kind of the extreme example, but a very practical one from our time, once again. Maybe somebody with venereal disease or an unwanted pregnancy isn't going to be quite so attracted to fornication as when it looked like it was a carefree little experience with no consequences and just fun time. And that's part of the physical learning experience and spiritual learning experience. And I'm sure you could all say from your own experience what you learned by suffering. And it's a hard teacher, but God has built it right into life in the flesh, and it's a good teacher. And hopefully we don't have to learn everything this way, but you won't get through human life without learning some things this way. That there are consequences to sin, and because we're in the flesh, that flesh is going to suffer. So will our minds. I don't mean to exclude the mind. There is mental suffering as well as physical suffering. And as I was saying last time, that seems to speed the learning process. It almost gives us an advantage over angels. You know, we've got more ways to suffer. Isn't that nice? What an advantage. But it is an advantage. Spiritually speaking, we get the consequences of sin come in faster and harder on a physical body, and we should learn from it.
And if a person's gone through some real suffering, it does tend to wake them up. And I know there's a certain maturity in people who have suffered, even though it might not have been just immediately from sin. But I know the students that I know in college that have maybe had a brush with death and really had maybe a major operation or something like that. Often they're very humble. And they know their frailty, they know their mortality, and they just don't waste a lot of time sinning. They know life is precious and dear, and it only lasts so long, and they're going to live it right. And other people who have never dealt with their mortality, never seen any limitations, which is some of you, and I was that way very much myself in coming through college. I didn't, frankly, face my limitations until I was in my late 30s, when they all seemed to come in all at once. Oh, you know, going through a graduate school, going through divorce, losing kids, losing money, this thing like, you know, all of a sudden, boy, did I learn a lot about my limitations in between about 35 and 40. And might have wished it could have come sooner, but it comes one way or the other. College was pretty easy. First few years, you know, right into the field ministry as a young kid, 21 years of age. Can you believe that? How many of you are older than 21 right now? Okay, I was pastoring churches in West Texas at 21. No, sorry, make that 22. I was ordained at 21 in May, turned 22 in June, went on a baptizing tour that summer, came back and raised up churches late that summer before the Feast of Trumpets. So, green as a gourd, you know, and doing all these wonderful things. Well, you know, early success, but you still have to sort things out. You know, it isn't going to keep that up forever. And so later there were a lot of other things to face and address. But it's okay. Suffering in the flesh will sure change your attitude toward a lot of things, including sin. It will make you more humble and more obedient to God. I don't wish suffering on you, but you're not going to escape it entirely. And when it happens, what can I say? Be glad for it. Count it all joy when you fall into different kinds of trials and tests. Sounds like a strange formula, but the Bible gives that. They'll be worth it. I tell you, you will learn some of the most important things in your life through suffering. How many would say you've already seen that to be true? Okay, you know what I mean. You know, you don't learn sometimes the biggest lessons easy. Seems like the lessons you can learn easy are not the biggest lessons. Seems like the ones you learn hard and tough are the big ones and the valuable ones. And boy, you learn them. I'm never, ever going to do that again. You know, I know where that jumps out. That is a dead end where all you do is get beat up and messed up, and I'm not going to do it. It gives you a determination. It isn't just theory anymore, right? You know, it's experiential learning. My body suffered when I did that. I don't want to do that anymore. Okay, that he should no longer live the rest of his time in the flesh to the lusts of men. That's human beings, right? Not Christ. He didn't live his life in the flesh to the lusts of men. That's why it's a small h to them. But to the will of God. That's where we come out on this thing. What does God want with my life? I'm tired of doing it my way. It doesn't work. I just mess up, make myself and a lot of other people unhappy. How do I get myself in harmony with God's will and yield to it and say with Christ, Father, not my will, but thine be done. You know what? There will still be some suffering. Life in obedience to God isn't without suffering. I can't say you instantly then leap to the side of the ledger where no more suffering occurs. But it's more meaningful, and it pays off, and you're more agreeable to it. Television during the course of the last few years has had some ups and downs in what I could describe generally as suffering. You know, not every day, but it isn't always fun. But I'm agreeable to it, because it makes sense. At least it's suffering for the right reasons and not because I'm being stupid, you know, and it has a far greater reward in the end. We have spent enough of our past lifetime, Peter says, in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in, and maybe this is a little bit of commentary on how Peter lived his life prior to conversion. Licentiousness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In other words, enough is enough. We've done this, okay? Let's get out of it. In regard to these, they, your former friends, think it strange that you do not run with them to the same flood of dissipation. Excess of riot is the King James version there, kind of cute. You don't riot enough, they're saying. Ever go back and get in touch with you? You shouldn't do this. It's very risky business, but former friends, you know, outside the church, maybe even inside the church, and now you've been to AC and you've cleaned up your act, and they want to do certain things that you used to do with them, and you're saying no, and they think it's strange. Hey, how come? You used to party hard, you fell. What's the matter? You know, can't handle it anymore? You know, they're putting you down. Well, they think it's strange that you won't do that. God doesn't think it's strange, and you don't think it's strange, but people who haven't made similar changes will think it's strange that you won't run along with them what's called here the same flood of dissipation.
You picked your blood roaring along, and that's what you were in before,
dissipating yourself at a rapid rate.
And so they'll, this is curious, they'll speak evil of you, because Satan calls evil good and good evil. Pretty straight these days, aren't we? You know, boy, AC's really changed you, fella, you know. Yellow pencil, like all the rest of those do-gooder AC types. I know about you. Ridicule, scorn, you know. Can you handle that? They think it's weird that you don't sin as much as you used to. Okay. Whose value system do you buy? Theirs or God's, you know? Maybe you should think it's strange that they still sin as much as they used to. Who's really strange? You know, how much sin do you need, friend? You know, how much do you need to be in this flood of dissipation? You're going to drown in it? Is that how far you've got to swim around in that stuff?
It is weird, though, how Satan, so often, he reverses things on you. Called evil good and good evil. They will give an account to him who's ready to judge the living and the dead. So, okay, you'll have to stand and answer to God for your own stuff someday. Verse 6 needs a comment as well. For this reason, the gospel is preached also to those who are dead. When did Christ preach to the dead?
Before they were dead, okay? That's the point. There's no way you can preach to dead people because they're dead. But prior to their being dead, the gospel was preached to various people in various ways, even including the Old Testament times. In a general way, they heard certain features of the gospel, not in its entirety, to be sure. But certain things were taught them about the laws of God or whatever, and they're going to also be judged according to men in the flesh, but live according to God in the Spirit. So everybody gets a certain amount of witness, some get more, and we're certainly very accountable. The end of all things is at hand, Peter says, be serious and watchful in your prayers. And then he gives some practical admonitions here. Above all things, have fervent love for one another. Love will cover a multitude of sins. Mind you, that requires some comment. If you're loving, what? God will excuse all your sins? No, the wrong interpretation. But the love, it isn't that you can be loving and God erases the sins on your account. But the proper understanding, as I understand this verse, is that in love, you will not expose sin, talk about it, but tend to cover it. A loving approach to somebody else's sin is to cover it, bury it, contain the damage. Don't let it out. Don't talk about it. Don't spread it around the campus or the church. Cover it and conceal it so that it doesn't spread and the person's reputation is ruined. That's the only right-handed understanding of that verse, because it simply isn't true that if you think you are loving, God will excuse all of your sins. That's ridiculous. That's kind of a Protestant, silly, licentious grace approach. Be hospitable to one another. Hospitality is encouraged here by Peter without grumbling. What's the King James version of that? Anybody have it? Old-timey King James? Everybody's got the new King James. What's your version of it? Without grudging, okay. Did you simply say be hospitable? Or use hospitality. Use hospitality. I kind of like that. Just on an ongoing basis, use your home. When you get your little life set up, get a table, chairs, you know, dishes, forks and spoons, refrigerator, you know, get set up so you can do hospitality. And then do it. And be hospitable. It's a wonderful service in the church. And whatever gift you have, use them. If you're speaking, do that. And ministering, do that. Very similar to Romans passage there in chapter 12, which says much the same thing. There were fiery trials that this church was experiencing. It says in verse 12, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial. I think various commentaries have suggestions as to what this is. I'm not sure if they know for sure. Most of Peter's activities were probably outside the confines of the Roman Empire, at least many of them were, as he went to Israel, and this whole book is directed to Israelites, as you know. Pilgrims of the dispersion in places like Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia. That's partly Roman territory, and some was outside of it, or on the borders of it, and probably a little bit of both, actually. But then I think in some of those areas of northern, what we call Turkey today, or Asia Minor, were kind of disputed territories, and some were, Peter did seem to have activities outside of it as well. In any case, there were trials that were going on in the church, and we can only speculate what they were, but they were fiery, and they were being persecuted. He said, don't think that's strange. Actually, what's strange is what we have in the history of the Church of God. The peace, the prosperity, and the freedom that we're experiencing is a strange anomaly in the history of the seven eras of the church. This is the only one that ever had it so good. I mean, had this. Campuses, you know, freedoms, wealth, classes, teachers, facility. Went horseback riding yesterday. Beautiful. You know, there's a lovely lake. We have got it so good. It's like we live the millennium in the midst of Satan's world. Why, most Christians didn't have it that way. Let's keep that in mind. In the early times of the church and the centuries that followed, persecuted, hounded, driven away. Have you studied church history enough to know what it was like to be a Christian in the year 200, 300, 500, 800, you know, dark in the Middle Ages, Catholic Church totally in control? I mean, it's just incredible how good we have it. I hope that doesn't somehow ruin us. Seems like persecution does have a way of keeping people honest and close to God. Let's hope we can handle the prosperity and not drift into the Laodicean attitude that so many will be in the end times. Anyway, that's not strange, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's suffering. If you do that, if it comes to us, will we do that? Will we rejoice and be glad with exceeding joy? Christ said much the same thing. That we're to rejoice similarly. Matthew, I believe it is chapter 5, when we're persecuted. And I think very similar phrases used there about being very glad about that. I don't know if I can easily find it. I'm not entirely used to this new Bible. Things don't appear where they should, as they did in my old King James Version here. But, yes, it is in chapter 5 and verse 44. Let's see, where he says about being real happy about all that. Blessed are those who revile you. Yeah, rejoice, verse 12. Here it is, 5:12. And be exceedingly glad. Peter's saying the same thing. Exceedingly joyful about persecution. That's tricky. But that's one of the strongest statements Christ made in the Sermon on the Mount. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad when you get persecuted, for great is your reward in heaven. And if you're not focused on that, if you're only focused on the immediate and the persecution, you're not going to find that very enjoyable at all. But if you say some of the greatest rewards that are ever going to be given are going to be in response to persecution, great is your reward in heaven. If you've got a future perspective and not just a present human perspective, you can do this. Mr. Armstrong was persecuted exceedingly throughout the course of his lifetime in ministry. Took a lot of shots, a lot of cheap shots, right down to the end. And he's going to have a great reward. And I predict Mr. DeCosta will take his. It's inescapable. I sometimes think, well, you know, in the calm before the storm. I can't prove it. I don't want to be paranoid or have a persecution complex. But I just know the dealings of Satan on the church, you know. We are in a marvelously beautiful time of consolidation. God has given us time after Mr. Armstrong's death to get things organized and cinched up. And that's wonderful. A smooth transition of power to the next leader. What a good God he is. Not to let Satan just hammer on us in the days right after Mr. Armstrong's death and everything just fall apart. He didn't do that. He preserved us. But I still say there will be those, you know, false ministers, false brethren, and persecution from without that is out there, and I hope we're all ready for it when it comes. As we reproach, he says, verse 14, in the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and God rests upon you. Can you see it that way? Well, you don't really know because you haven't been tried too much that way. We haven't had this experience. But, he says, verse 15, don't be suffering as a murderer, a thief, or an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters. So, if you're going to be persecuted, let it be for the right reasons. Not everybody is. You know, some people get persecution, if you want to call it that. Really, they're getting what they deserve. They do stupid things. I think in the, you know, televangelism world, the so-called persecution that the Bakers and Earl Roberts and these other people are getting, is it persecution, or is it just cause and effect? They probably see it as persecution. But when you do dumb things like stand in a water fountain and anoint your wallet and pray for money to come in, I just think, you know, people don't think that's wonderful. If you take slides off high towers, you know, at an amusement park to convince your followers you're, what, elitist? This is how you do it. I mean, they do these theatrical antics and engage in these dumb things, and then people don't like it. Let's not get persecuted for that, okay? Let's not be stupid. We're going to be persecuted, let it be for righteousness and not just being dumb. Verse 16, if anybody suffers as a Christian, does the old King James say Christian here as well? Yes, I think so. I think that's the first and maybe the only use of the term Christian in the New Testament. Anybody know different? Anybody know any other place that says Christian? Come on, my memory says that that is the only use of the term in the Bible. In Acts, isn't there another term? Well, they were called Christians, right? Okay, there is one in Acts, right. Remember that. That's the first use of the term, evidently. It doesn't appear a lot, but here Peter does, for perhaps it's the second time.
in the scripture to turn Christian appears. If you're suffering that way, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this manner.
I would say most of the persecution I've taken has not been because of my wonderful Christianity.
Most of the consequences I've suffered have been from my own mistakes. But if sometime in the future people are persecuting the gospel, how many times can we come out like I'm going to do on the Christmas program and just say right out loud for 1.25 million people to hear, Christmas is not Christian. Just plain and simple. And you follow that, the arguments in there. They're pretty convincing. They're pretty tight script. Go through that whole thing and show how rankly taken it is and how the Roman Church compromised to put it into the sacred calendar and walk through the whole thing for 30 minutes and come to the bottom line and say, Christmas isn't Christian. I'm sorry if that comes in the shock or disappointment, but that's, you know, proved by both history and the scripture. You better believe it. How many times can we do that without somebody saying, I hate you. You know, I'm going to make trouble for you. I'm amazed that we do this season after season and we just come whistling through. It's amazing. But at some point in time, isn't somebody going to say, enough is enough of these heretics? We're going to get them off the air. We're going to make life rough for them. I don't look forward to that day. But to me, it's amazing that we don't. I mean, in the course of a weekend where we get 20, 30, 40,000 responses, the number of really nasty responses you can usually count on one or two hands. It's just amazing. The open door, you know, that's what Christ says. When I set before you an open door, nobody's going to shut it. We've got this tremendous open door right now. We're going through it. But I anticipate it's going to be otherwise somewhere down the line. Better be ready for it. Glorify God. The time for judgment has begun on the house of God. That's us. That's now. We know about this verse. We are being judged. It's beginning with us. What's going to happen to those who don't obey the gospel? When this judgment process continues and Christ judges the whole world, when he does what Dr. Meredith likes to talk about, spanks this world, you know, for its sins, what's going to happen to them? They're going to be in worship. If the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and sinner appear? Well, and ultimately, in the lake of fire, and short of that, in tribulation, and having a lot of difficulties. Therefore, let us who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as a faithful creator. Okay, any particular questions or unresolved difficulties in either chapters 3 or 4 that we have covered? I feel a little awkward about the fact that Dr. Ward said, finish 1 Peter, and it doesn't look like we're going to. But we got into a culturally relevant discussion. And one of my biggest things in life is relevance. I didn't give a speech lecture that they asked me to give, but had I done so, I would have told the guys in there, some of you, the most devastating, precise, insightful questions you can ever ask about anybody's speeches, so what? Does that put things in focus in a hurry? In other words, how does it relate? What's it got to do with the price of putty, as you say, or tomatoes, or whatever? How do I apply it? What does it mean? What is the hook? How do I use it? And my feeling is that what we say better be relevant and useful. That's why I love the social programs on the telecast, and I'm okay on doctrine and about prophecy. You know, prophecy is going to happen whether I say anything about it or not. Somebody should say something about it. But I like the program, what you can do about alcoholism or others, you know, that are immediately practical and relevant. I don't know if that's perfect balance, but it's just my feeling about things. I'd rather get in there and deal with those kinds of issues. So that's why I bet all my chips on 1 Peter 3, and we didn't get to chapter 5. But it's a wonderful passage of Scripture, and whoever covers it with you, probably Dr. Ward, I'm sure, will love doing so, but may not love being one chapter behind in his master's schedule. But I'll be gone by then. I'm sure he'll sort it out real well. He's been persecuted before, and he can handle it.